Just a quick reminder that the comments, views, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of WCOM, its board, and its underwriters.
Hello, and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, I want to start a series on government contracting and grant compliance, what for-profit entities need to know, and the compliance requirements and why they matter, why they're not optional, and why they're good for your business, not just because they're required, but because they give you a robust way to run your business. And so what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of the requirements that the government imposes on government contractors and government grant recipients are just sound business practices that businesses evolve into in later stages if they're successful. And the reasons that those systems are required early and as related to government contracts and government grants agreements is because the government wants your business well run. They want to be able to see you documenting the costs, the price, the elements of how you're doing business with them. And from their perspective, they're doing it to safeguard our tax dollars that are flowing to your business to deliver a product or service or research. And so it's really critical that you understand how the requirements come into place and what those requirements are. I'm going to limit this conversation to for-profit entities, for-profit commercial entities that are required to do business under FAR, Federal Acquisition Regulation 31, and some of the other regulations. And I want to get into some of those, but I'm going to kind of give an overview today and then get into specifics with each system requirement and each expectation that the government has over several shows. So today I want to talk about why you comply, how you find out what the requirements are, what type of audits you may be facing, and that the requirements may or may not be spelled out directly in your contract or the award document, but may have been incorporated at the time that the solicitation was put out. And so meaning the solicitation plus your proposals that you've submitted become part of the contract, the agreement, terms, and conditions, and that you have to be truthful in these documents. Lying to the government is a very, very bad thing. And so when we're talking about requirements that come in, it would be nice to think that just because I'm a small business, maybe a one or two person shop, I don't have to comply with these requirements. Well, you don't have to comply with requirements that they're the same as a government defense contractor, but you're going to have to comply with the requirements that are specific to the law that created the program you're engaging in or the need or the acquisition that you're participating in, that are applicable to the creation of the agencies, that are in the federal acquisition regulations that are incorporated, that is in the specific program authorization that your funding flows from, and all these other requirements that are incorporated just because the government says you must comply with all the laws and regulations. And so sometimes we don't even think about what that means and how broad that makes a requirement. That means you have to comply with all labor laws. And that means overtime, time off, work week reporting, new hire reporting, any number of things. And tax laws, you have to be current on your sales tax and your use tax filings in all the states where you're required to do that. You have to pay your property taxes. You have to get your payroll taxes right. There's just so many things that you need to understand that when you become a government contractor, that it's not those are new requirements, but those are the requirements that were in place, but these are requirement for all businesses. And those requirements can get examined and reveal that you have not been complying with those. So those standard business things of getting your taxes paid at the state, federal, local level, getting business licenses, all of those kind of things come into play and become more visible when you become a government-funded business, whether it's through a grant or through an acquisition contract. So compliance requirements from the federal government and state, local, municipalities, whoever's providing your funding, who is making a purchase as a government entity from your business, or is making a purchase from a prime, and you're a subcontractor or a pass-through recipient under those agreements, they are committed to identifying criminal, civil, and administrative processes that prevent, detect, and address, punish, prosecute the non-compliant activities and organizations that receive funds from the government. So if you're old enough, you may remember all the fraud and overcharging and outrageous prices of the 70s and the 80s. That was just sort of the tip of the iceberg beginning of why government regulations and compliance requirements were increased. We've seen in more recent years Enron, the WorldComs, and those kind of things that have caused the need for more monitoring, more specificity in requirements and results, create a shift to monitoring. For-profit entities in particular are vulnerable to the audits and the non-compliance that those audits reveal. So what we have to be aware of is that there are rules such as the False Claims Act that is a major enforcement tool where lying to the government, making false claims, becomes a criminal act. So if we want to put it in non-government acquisition terms, if we want to look at recent cases of people who lied to the government and what they lie about was not a crime, but the fact they lied to the investigators was the crime. Martha Stewart went to jail, not for insider trading, but for lying to the government. Making false claims is a larger codified aspect of procurement rules that apply to government contractors and has five categories that the government focuses on to make sure that you're complying in your business with all the rules, the regulations, and the requirements for working with the government and doing it honestly and with integrity and complying with the rules. So those categories of non-compliance, of procurement fraud or misrepresentation fall into categories of mischarging your costs to the government, whether that's materials or labor, substituting something for what the government purchased, so a more inferior product, a completely different product, substituting a less qualified person to perform the work, to corruption and actual how you interact with the government, so bribes, incentives, kickbacks, those types of things. Eligibility for and compliance with specific programs. So if it's a small business program and you're a nonprofit and you say you go after an award saying you're a small business and you're not a small business, you're a nonprofit. Or in the fifth category, pricing to the government that's defective. And I can get into that in more detail. But giving the government a price that's not accurate or representative of the cost or the pricing that's out on those products to commercial and non-commercial customers. And so it means essentially overcharging or arriving at a price that's not based in fact. And so that's why we get back to the cost or the business systems, the contract performance business systems that are focused on cost allowability, cost accounting, tracking of time, proper invoices to the government, and the six key business systems that the government looks at for government contractors that are accounting, purchasing, earned value management systems, cost estimating, materials management, and property and asset management. And as I was saying just a little bit ago, the requirement to be a business, a for-profit business, following the rules, paying your taxes, getting the appropriate authorizations for business licenses, permits, complying with OSHA laws, wage and hour laws, all of those types of things are critical to understanding the foundation, the minimum requirements that you're supposed to be meeting as a normal business, and then overlaying those with the visibility that occurs when you become a government contractor subject to audits, either government audits or audits of under government auditing rules by independent auditors. And at this point, I want to make a little comment too. We remember Arthur Anderson and Enron, where Arthur Anderson was the audit firm, consulting firm, you know, pretty much everything. And their audits did not reflect a true independence of audit, because the auditors were advising, they were consulting, they were doing all these types of things to the client, and their independence had been impaired. The relationship was so tight between Arthur Andersen and Enron that for Arthur Andersen to say Enron failed an audit put Arthur Andersen at risk. And so that's why we ended up with Sarbanes-Oxley laws and all these things that came out of that, to make sure that we have independent auditors. And when the government auditors come in, they're independent. They're going to come into your organization from the Department of Defense Contractors Audit Agency, or from Office of Inspector General, or from private sector firms that have gone through an acquisition process to get a contract to be an auditor for the government to come in and examine your operations. And these people are going to come in and they're going to be looking at things. And it's not just an invoice. It's not just your accounting system. It's not just the technical aspects of the contract. It is to see that you are in business and doing business legally and according to the rules and the regulations that are normal to business that is not a government contractor and as a government contractor. When they start peeling back that onion, and 20 years ago when I first got into working for or with companies that are government funded or government contractors, I experienced my first audit of a number of government contracts a week after I stepped into the chief financial officer role. And that was a tough week because I had started reading all these government contracts. I had come out of companies that did government contracts, but they weren't in, that wasn't part of the business I was in. And so I'm reading all these clauses and I'm realizing, oh, we're not doing this and we're not doing that. And oh, there's no way we've been doing that. And going through those requirements. And when the auditor then was there, that day they arrived, it wasn't just the government defense contract auditor. It was also the North Carolina Department of Revenue and the North Carolina Department of Sales and Use Taxes. And so I walked into three different audits being conducted in conjunction with each other, and that was a mess. And so here I just looked at him and said, yeah, you're right. Nothing's right. How much time do I have to fix this? Because the company had been around about 10 years at that point. And I was just figuring out what they were doing, having just newly arrived to the company and starting to look at the requirements. And oddly enough, that statement of, yes, you're right, they're not doing it, no tap dancing, no whatever. I said, I wasn't here. I need some time to start straightening this out, figuring out what wasn't done, what needed to be done, where the noncompliance was, what could be corrected, what needed, remediation or repayment, those types of things. And so we started down a path of correcting mistakes, fixing the system, and then working with the government auditors at all levels to make sure the company became compliant and was doing everything properly, accounting systems, invoicing, everything. And so it was a complete overhaul of the business systems of that entity. And why did it matter? Because the consequences for not being compliant can be the repayment, at a minimum, the repayment of all the funds that came in, plus interest and penalties. It can be civil penalties over and above that. And it can be criminal charges to people if it's deemed that they have committed criminal acts of fraud, misrepresentation, lying to the government, defective pricing, all of these little elements that we were talking about, mischarging the government, substituting an inferior product or an unqualified person to perform the work, corruption in the relationship between the contractor and the government. So did they try to do anything to incentivize the government to look the other way? Eligibility for and compliance with the requirements that were in each contract. And looking back at that, it's like that organization was doing research. I think we had 17 scientists doing research, and we had a number of federal contracts that were restricted to only U.S. employees, U.S. citizens to be able to do it, and only one of our scientists met that requirement. And so it's important to read the agreement, especially if you're a small business, you're new to this. It's important to read through the agreement, understand every aspect of it, read through from the time you see a solicitation and you decide to start down this path and you go into the SAM system to register your business to do business with the government. Understand what it means to certify that you self-certify you're a small business or you're a minority-owned business or you're a disabled veteran business. Understand what it is you're saying about your organization and make sure it's true. And so when the government's looking at this, they are trying to protect our tax dollars. And so understand that their goal is to come in and identify where you are not complying, where internal controls have failed, where your accounting's not doing the right thing, where your invoices are incorrect, if you're not keeping records and you're not doing the timekeeping, which is mandatory for for-profit entities doing business with the government, whether it's grant or acquisition. Timesheets, 100% of your employees have to keep timesheets and properly record that time on a daily basis. And so we'll get into that in another show in detail as to what the timekeeping and accounting requirements are. But you have to understand the basics of what you are agreeing to do. You can't become a government contractor or grant recipient and pick and choose what parts of the compliance requirements and the terms and conditions of your award or your contract you're going to comply with. If you accept the contract, if you accept the money, you accept the terms. They're not optional. You might not like them. May not like how they transform and change how you do business and how you interact with your employees. And that's fine. Don't accept the contract. Don't take the money. If you won't do the requirements, if you're not going to comply, then don't take the funds. It's as simple as that. If you're taking and becoming a government contractor or you're a grant recipient and there are terms and conditions that come with it, accept the cost of compliance. Accept that you're accepting those terms and conditions the moment you sign the contract or get the first dollar in payment from the prime or the government, whichever is the contracting entity. We don't want to make false statements. You don't want to misrepresent what your business has as a capability and what you are doing. So whether that's technical, whether that's on the business aspects of it, you are there to comply and to communicate accurately your degree of compliance and your with all the requirements and your capabilities. There are a number of ways that the government can come at you for those misrepresentations, both criminal and civil. And I always tell my clients, I don't look good in orange and I don't look good in horizontal stripes. I'm not sure about you, but orange is not a color I want to be familiar with and wear on a daily basis. For me, orange is not the new black. And compliance is critical to your organization. Contract performance business systems is what I specialize in with my clients. And those business systems are sound business systems for my government contract clients and my non-government contract clients because they put in place structures that communicate to you what your business is doing, what's generating your costs, and the relationships of those costs and expenditures to your activities. And so when you get down to looking at your accounting system and it can tell you that because you have a certain project, a government project, the first government project, you're incurring all of these compliance and business system change costs, then you can capture that. If you're only ever going to go after one government contract and let's say it's got a profit of $10,000 on it and your compliance for that contract is going to cost you $60,000 or even $10,001. Then you don't want to do it. If you're going into business to be a government contractor, to be a grant recipient, or a combination of both, then you need to look at the costs that are going to be incurred to get your business into the format to be compliant with the regulations, with those business system requirements, and to perform on the contract under all terms and conditions, not just the technical and product or research aspects of it, but all the conditions. Then that is an investment in your organization creating a government, contracting a government activity in your organization. It's an investment. For it to pay off, you have to do it right, you have to do it completely, and you have to be pursuing more contracts with the government. Something that a lot of my clients are not familiar with, we've heard more and more about whistleblowers. But under the government contracting realm, there's also something called KTAM. And that's essentially, I believe it translates to something to the effect on behalf of the king. But that's where someone that works in your organization or interacts with your organization or knows your organization becomes aware of your noncompliance, your false statements, your overcharging, your fraud, whatever it is you're doing, and can, because of their knowledge, actually sue you on behalf of the government and go through that process to reveal and recover what you've done and recover those costs. And the government will, on a good suit, take over those suits. And because the person will likely have the documentation, will have the knowledge, you're in trouble. And it's going to be expensive, it's going to be long, and it's going to be hard on your organization if someone comes forward and says you're committing fraud against the government and they have the documentation. You may not think of it as fraud when you don't keep timesheets. No one wants to do it, so you don't do it. Or you do it, but it's just, you know, printing out something that says 8-8-8-8-8 every day. That's not a valid timesheet. That's misrepresenting information to the government. And so we really have to think about making a strategic decision when you're going to go to be a direct prime contractor or a subcontractor to a prime on a government contract and all the strings that come along with those opportunities and the costs that go along with those strings. So once you become a government contractor or subcontractor or are funded through government grants or other funding instruments, cooperative agreements, for instance, or broad agency announcement responses, you have to understand that it's going to impact every aspect of your business. I do mean every aspect of your business. Your accounting system and how it's structured, your purchasing practices. If you're large enough and the contract's large enough, an earned value management system that's connecting your activities and your project progress to your accounting system and how the money is being spent and the progress being made in return for those dollars, your cost estimating. How do you arrive and cost and do bids and proposals and those types of things? And so how your business is put in structure to capture costs and use those costs to pursue more business or to report costs, material management, property and asset management. You're going to be complying with labor laws. You may accept a contract. And if you remember back a few years ago under the Obama administration, let's say minimum wage was, I don't know, $7.25, whatever it was. And he, by executive order, increased it to $10. Well, that was a change, and that was a new compliance as a government contractor. All government contractors had to start paying more. Well, what if you don't have the money in that contract? What if you don't have the money in the bank to have a wage increase? What happens when your contract goes away and now you're paying everybody more? What is that strategic decision? So we have to realize that in some aspects of what we're doing, we have to understand that there are things that are not specifically spelled out in the project contract or the award document that we have to comply with. And you may or may not be complying with them now because they weren't requirements, say FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, or let's say Americans with Disabilities Act. So there's just different things that are in there that you may not have had to do because you don't have enough employees. The requirement hasn't kicked in due to your company size, but you suddenly get your contract and you see that you now have to comply with FMLA or you have to comply with the Davis-Bacon Act on prevailing wages. There's just all of these different elements that come in, and being aware of them and at least at the high level, not necessarily at the, you know, transactional level yet, when you make the decision to become a government contractor, you have to comply. You can be individually liable for noncompliance and have personal liability and personal consequences for noncompliance. If you're signing off on a report that says all this information is correct and you sign every invoice to send to the government, but that information in that invoice is not correct, you didn't keep timesheets, or you're not a small business and you have a small business contract, then you are liable for your misstatement and your misrepresentation, your signature on that document. Same thing with timesheets. It's got to be an accurate timesheet. If you're signing that it's not accurate, or you've told somebody 20 years ago this was more common, you would have companies that would have employees charge their time to the most expensive, the contract that had the highest rate, whether that was where they were working or not. or everybody would charge 40 hours, whether that was how many hours they worked in the week or not. They might work 60, 80, or 100, but they only charged 40 to everything, and so the per hour rate was higher. So you've got to understand compliance requirements and how they're going to impact your organization, from reporting to your accounting system, to invoicing requirements, to record-keeping requirements, to audit requirements. And so you may end up paying for your own independent auditor who specializes in government contracts or grants to come in annually and audit your organization. That may be a requirement. That can cost you, on average, my clients probably pay $25,000 a year as small businesses for those audits to be performed on their grants and government contracts. Why? Well, it's a requirement in some of their awards. And on the flip side, some of them like to have the independent audit and the review of their internal controls and their systems, their rates, all the aspects of being compliant to have on hand for when the government auditors come in. I have had clients in the past that have had expert government auditors come in, do their audit, an independent audit firm during the government audit, following the rules, get a clean bill of health, and 2 weeks later, a government audit agency will come in and say, no, everything's wrong. You fail. And so here you have CPA firms, audit firms with the expertise and the experience to say, no, we've already looked at this. We looked at the timesheets that were 100% compliant. We looked at the invoicing. We tracked the payroll records. We verified their internal controls. We've done all this. Your finding is incorrect. You have something to back that up that's independent, assuming the auditor is qualified and the auditor is truly independent. And that gets back to the point I started to make earlier, is that we had Arthur Andersen and Enron conflicts of interest. It's critical that you have qualified independent auditors that are not going to be influenced by your relationship with them. So they're not influenced by concern for losing the fees for doing management consulting with you. If they're doing your consulting on how your business should run, how things should be set up, helping you set up your accounting system, they can't audit it. They're not independent to say it's right or it's wrong because it's their work. If they're preparing your taxes, and let's say you're a mid-sized company and it costs $100,000 a year to do your taxes and you're going to pay them $25,000 to do an audit. If they fail you in an audit, what do they think is going to happen to their tax, the $100,000 in tax business they're getting from you? So that kind of thing is to make sure that they are qualified. I had a client in North Dakota a while ago that had gone through audits every year from an independent accounting firm, passed those audits for years. They were 98% government contractor. When the government came in and audited, they failed the audits, and they legitimately failed the audits because the independent audit firm that they had been using hadn't used the appropriate standards, didn't understand the requirements, and was not qualified to perform the type of audit that was required. And so how do you deal with that? Because now you think you've done everything. Your auditor's telling you, yes, you're compliant and everything, and suddenly you wake up one day and find out not only are you not compliant, your entire business could be shut down and taken because you're 98% funded by the government and you're going to lose that. They're not going to make another payment. You're going to owe them all the money back for all the years that you've been a government contractor. And people are at risk because you were representing it. You were doing everything right and you really legitimately thought you were. You were passing audits and you weren't doing everything right. And so how do we deal with that, and what do we do with things? And so it's important to understand the requirements, at least at the high level. People in your organization have to understand them at the appropriate level throughout the organization. And as management, you have to understand your role and what you can and you cannot do once you become a government contractor. I want to talk about timekeeping, but I want to talk to it as an illustration of why it matters and how it translates to management responsibility. So time charging or timekeeping and the document maintenance of those systems for accumulating those labor costs and reporting those labor costs and using them as a basis to charge the government the direct cost of those that labor and any indirect costs recoverable. That upper management has requirements. They have a requirement to set the standard. They have a requirement to establish the policies and procedures that meet the requirements. They have the requirement to establish the cost allocation policy that's going to translate those timekeeping records into the appropriate cost buckets. They are responsible for making sure every employee understands the requirements, what that timesheet means, what's supposed to be done, how it's supposed to be filled out, how it's what records are supposed to be, if it's like to the quarter hour, to the half hour you're tracking, the end of every day, the time needs to be there, what it means to sign that time statement and say that it is accurate for how the work was performed. And they are also responsible for making sure internal audits of those timekeeping records are performed. Now, if you're an organization that says, well, we don't want to do the timekeeping and we're not going to meet those requirements, then as upper management, there's nowhere to hide. You are on the hook because you've made that decision. You're supposed to be aware of the requirements that you have as upper management to do that. And if you're blatantly disregarding it, pray that the auditor does not come in your door. Middle managers are responsible for ensuring that those timesheets accurately reflect what the employee is doing. They're usually what's considered the cognizant or knowledgeable member of management. They're the ones signing off on the timesheets saying, these items are correct. That, yes, I know this employee worked this many hours on these projects. They're responsible for that review and that approval, that stamping that says, yes, it's correct. And they're responsible for making sure that those hours and those costs are appropriately charged to their budgets, to the appropriate projects, etc. Non-supervisory employees are responsible for their time card. And so that means every person is responsible for knowing that because I have a government contract, my company does, I'm required to keep a time card. If your company doesn't ask you for a time card, what do you do? We'll talk about that on a show that we're going to do about timekeeping and time charging and tracking those costs later in the year. Now, your accounting department is also responsible for making sure those timesheets come in, they get properly costed for the labor rates, that the hours get charged to the right projects, to the right categories or buckets, the direct costs, the overhead, the fringe, paid time off type things, and if something's unallowable. They need to validate that the timesheets go into the payroll system properly and the payroll system and costs come over to the projects properly and that they're going to be invoiced properly. But I cannot understate, I have to emphasize this, the consequences for management of a government contractor blatantly disregarding timekeeping requirements. I don't even like to think of the penalties and the issues that could arise. I don't think for a company of any size or any stage to risk your entire organization's viability and life or your career for non-compliance with that specific requirement just does not make sense to me. And so that's something I emphasize with my clients is that this is not an optional thing. It's not a nice to have. It's not something that you can sort of do. You do it and you do it 100% because it's spelled out as to what upper management must do and what they're responsible to do. And so every aspect, every system that the government asks you to address has specific ties to what upper management is supposed to do, to what the leadership of the organization is supposed to do, to what the accounting department, the finance department is supposed to do, to what procurement is supposed to do, and to what the internal and external auditors are supposed to do. And so it's critical. I can't. I overstate this. And it kills me every time I have to tell a client I can't continue to work with them because I know they're non-compliant and have no intention of complying. I can advise, I can't make clients become compliant. I can spell out all the consequences and I can help them design the most effective, cost-effective, and efficient compliance system that they need for their organization based on what the requirements are. But the cost of not complying and getting caught is too high for any organization to make that choice. And so it's really hard to watch organizations put not just the cost of a contract at risk, but their entire organization's life and their employees' livelihoods at stake because they choose not to comply with something. And so business compliant contract performance business systems are all about maximizing the success of the organization to meet the requirements that the government imposes. But those requirements are just sound business practices 90% of the time. Having an accounting system that drives your organization to understand the true cost of a project and how much profit's there, or how much money is being spent on internal research that needs to be covered from profits, from investors, from crowdfunding, from whatever source you get your funds for those. What does it mean to recruit more and more people and the composition of those people? So if you've made a decision to have a lot of 1099 independent contractors versus employees because you have different projects, things flow in and out, you want the flexibility, it's important for your organization to understand the labor laws, the IRS code, the checklist, the distinction that is made to define someone that is truly an independent contractor and gets a 1099 versus a W-2 employee. When is a 1099 contractor not a 1099 contractor? When they don't meet the checklist standards that are established by the IRS for defining what an employee is and what's an independent contractor. I've had companies I've met with and said, well, we don't have to worry about overtime. We pay everybody a salary. Salary is not a determination of whether someone's eligible for overtime. Are they an exempt or non-exempt employee? And if you don't know the definition of those, we've looked at that before on the Fair Labor Standards Act conversation here on the show, and I can revisit it in a future show. But it basically says an exempt employee is an employee that falls into a category that is not eligible for overtime. A non-exempt employee is an employee that is eligible for overtime. And non-exempt employees may be salaried employees. If they're eligible for overtime, that just means you're going to take their salary, you're going to get an hourly rate for them, and you're going to pay them time and a half for every hour worked over 40 hours. Or whatever it is in your state, whether it's by the day or by the week. But you have to understand wage and hour laws, overtime rules, all aspects of that, and be compliant with those. Not just think you're compliant with them, but find out if you are. Because again, you're most vulnerable in every business. You are most vulnerable in your compliance with wage and hour laws and taxes. And with wage and hour laws, a few years ago, the overtime lawsuits for failure to pay overtime became, everyone thought they would be reduced when the rules became clear. And what they found was, no, it was almost an exponential growth in lawsuits from employees suing companies or going back and telling, reporting to the government, Department of Labor, or State Department of Labor, that they were eligible for overtime and their employer didn't pay them overtime. And so you have to understand what you can and cannot do as a for-profit business. You don't get to give comp time as a for-profit business. You can have a flexible work schedule in a week within that week, but you can't do that, you know, over a month. You can't flex it. So understand the requirements. Understand how you comply, the small ones and the big ones. You are vulnerable, and I mentioned it earlier, KTAM suits mean someone in your organization or someone formerly in your organization or somehow associated with your organization with reason to know that you're not compliant can go to the government and report you or can take you to court and sue you on behalf of the government for your fraud, your noncompliance. And that is a costly mistake for your business. You are most vulnerable when you are not complying from whistleblowers and people inside your organization that have knowledge and either say something casually to someone or it somehow leaks out, or they personally take action and blow the whistle on your organization for not doing it correctly. So let's kind of frame this up. Your business is supposed to be doing business according to the law. You may not always agree with the law. Heck, no one likes writing those big tax payments to the government. However, we know as the basics for being in business, doing business in the United States, doing business in your particular state, your particular county, your particular municipality, there are rules, there are taxes, there's OSHA standards, there's fire codes, there's business licenses, there's professional licenses, there's all these different things that you need to be having in place. If you are not complying with those, you're not even at the baseline for becoming a compliant government entity, receiving acquisition contracts or government funding through grants and other funding instruments. You need to get your business in shape. You don't know what your business shape your business is in, then it would be good to get an assessment of your business. I know I've gone into a number of businesses over the years just to talk with them and point them in the direction and say, let's look at this. Okay, you haven't done anything in, you know, your human resources. This is what's missing. Your accounting system's not doing this. You haven't paid the property taxes. You haven't been doing sales and use taxes. You've done this or you've not done that. You didn't go through and classify your employees exempt and non-exempt, and you've not paid overtime. One particular project I did, I want to think it's been about 9 years ago, we had to go back through 2 years' worth of timesheets and determine who was underpaid. In some cases, there was some overpayment regarding their time that was worked. Well, they were not paid overtime, and when you find that, you correct it. It's much less expensive and less costly. If there's something you've been doing wrong and you can correct it going forward, you correct what you can going back, and then you report what has happened and what you weren't able to correct. I call it, for some clients, I've had to tell them they're going to fall on their sword to get things straightened out. And we've had really good results with that. And that the government looks at it, and I have not had an instance where we've gone to the government and the government hasn't said, okay, get it. You didn't understand. You were required to understand. However, given that you fixed this, you're reporting it, here's how it's going to work. Whether that's been a sales and use tax issue, a property tax issue, a government contract issue, a government grant issue, it's better to put it on the table and fix it than it is to let it be discovered and end up in a court with a lawsuit or wearing orange on horizontal stripes. So again, the business systems we're going to be exploring and talking about compliance-wise are the accounting system. We're going to talk about purchasing and procurement practices. I'm going to talk to you about cost estimating systems and developing cost and pricing information. We'll talk about materials and property and asset management systems. And we'll talk about different labor laws, tax laws, and other things that are ancillary to this because you're expected to have already been doing them. But if you're not, what are you going to do? So we're going to get into the HR aspects, the human resources aspects of this. We're also going to talk about some intellectual property impacts and understanding government rights and intellectual property when they're in an acquisition contract versus a research and development type thing, an SBIR. The rules are different. And it's important to understand those differences. It's also important to understand that a lot of the interpretation of data rights and rights in data and software come down to how things are funded. And we want to dig into those. And I'm trying to get a guest on the show that is an expert, a national expert in U.S. government intellectual property rights under contracting and grants to come on. And we'll just jump into that in real detail when I get him scheduled to be on the show. The starting point for any organization is to clean up your accounting and your human resources part of your business and get compliant with that. Many HR consultants will come in and they can do the basics. They may or may not know and understand what happens under government contract rules and what has to be identified is going to be impacted by the type of contract you have or you're anticipating receiving. So it's also important that whoever you bring into your organization to work with you on this understands the complexity, understands that if you get a Department of Defense contract or you get something out of Health and Human Services, the difference. Is Homeland Security going to be different than the National Science Foundation for requirements? Yes. Is it different under acquisition and grants for those agencies? Well, it depends. And so there are aspects as a for-profit entity that you will have that are consistent and the same no matter what interaction you're having with the government. And then there are others that are different because of how the agencies function and how they operate. And so you have to understand that, for instance, National Science Foundation will pay out on a grant or funding instrument sometimes 75% of the total award up front. Well, just because they paid it to you and you've received it as cash into your business and it's set in your bank account does not mean it's there to be spent for just anything your business needs to do. It's there to be spent on the project that they are funding. They just happen to give you a cash flow infusion at the front to enable you to do and carry out the aspects of the contract that they've awarded to you. And so just because, let's say, you have $750,000 sitting in the bank from the National Science Foundation to perform on a contract does not mean you get to spend that money any way you can. It's only spent under the terms and conditions of that particular contract or award. So we're going to be exploring government contracting. We're going to look into each business system. We're going to look at the requirements. We're going to look at where things are different and talk about the expectations and the role upper management has, middle management. You as an employee may have, as the business owner may have, or an investor in a business that's a government contractor. As a board members frequently forget that they have liability, fiduciary responsibility for making sure that the organization of that they're on the board of is doing the right thing and they're keeping an eye on that. We're going to talk about audits, human resource aspects. We're going to cover this and unwind this onion, peel back this onion that is government contracting and talk about all the different aspects of doing business. Of how your business is going to be transformed for the positive. And yeah, it gets expensive. So there's some negative aspects of it. But it's better to be proactive and develop these systems and put them in place as early as you can because it's less costly to start out right than it is to go back and have to redo things and restate things, especially to go back several years and reconfigure and recalculate your financial statements for comparability and reporting when there are changes in how you've been reporting your information. I spent 18 months with one client going back through 3 years of their accounting and business information to properly classify and recreate and build a whole new accounting system. We took a snapshot of the way the accounting system had been, froze it, provided it to the audit firm, and then went in and had to go transaction by transaction from the conception of the organization. And thank God it was only 3 years. But look at every contract, every subcontract, every payment that was made, every project, every timesheet, all of those aspects of it, and recapture that information in the proper format and report it properly, recalculate rates, and then go to the government and say, okay, this is what we charged you. And this is what we should have charged you. We had to change audit firms because the audit firm had not caught the issues that were going on and they had given them a completely clean audits. And so we had to be proactive. The board had to get involved. And there were some changes in board members to put more independence and more financial expertise on the board. So there's a lot of things that take place. And if you're part of the management and oversight of the organization, if you're in the financial role, if you're a key project manager or a principal investigator on a government project, understanding the liability that you have as an individual and in your role in the organization, we're going to dig into a lot of this and try to find a flow that sometimes it feels like you're trying to drink out of a fire hose when you're learning what you know and what you don't know and what you need to know and how that's going to come into place. The government has a big emphasis now on business ethics and conduct codes and policies, business ethics, conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest, organizational conflicts of interest, and understanding what those are, how they translate to the board composition, to your advisory boards, to who's been hired in your organization. Been in client organizations where the founder and CEO was married to the vice president of finance. The controller was the wife of one of the board members. And you go through all that. And then the audit firm was the brother of one of the board members. Is there independence there? Where's the oversight? How are there conflicts of interest there? What's going on and how can we look at the internal controls? It's really important to analyze that, to determine that, and then to make the tough choices as to how the organization is going to emerge, how the organization is going to transform and become a better, stronger organization. You'll be different because you've accepted the rules and the conditions. You won't have the flexibility of not keeping timesheets. You won't have the flexibility of just sending any old format of an invoice to a customer because the government's going to tell you what the format of the invoice is. There's just so many aspects of how your business is going to change, and it will be worth it if you're compliant, if you're profitable, if you're able to compete successfully for government contracts and have a line of business that generates profitability and revenues for your organization. But it is an investment of time, of effort and understanding, and in transforming your organization and communicating with your organization why these new requirements are there, why they matter, how they're going to make things different, and how they're not going to make things different. What's not going to change? If you're working in items that are controlled by national security or information technology security requirements, sensitive information, confidential information, classified information, what does it mean for how your organization uses technology, how your employees use that technology, social media, instant messaging, telephones, personal devices, company devices being used for personal things, firewalls? There's so much of a complex organization and how our environment is becoming more complex with regard to IT security, just in the normal ways of protecting our organization. What does it look like when you become a government contractor dealing with sensitive, classified, or national security information or creating systems for national security? What does it mean? What is your organization going to look like? And make the right decisions to be compliant. Compliance is not optional. How you comply, the result of compliance, what your systems look like. The government dictates the outputs of your systems, the compliance requirements. They don't tell you which accounting system to use or which timekeeping system to use. Or even if you have to have an electronic timekeeping system, you can use manual timesheets. Everything could technically be manual. However, if the government is doing business with you and you're taking their money and you're signing the agreements, be aware that non-compliance is non-optional. There are consequences to it. And are you willing to risk your organization's health and welfare by choosing not to comply with even the most basic elements of those requirements? I have seen contracts with my clients over the years that come in that may be 5 pages long, but there's 4 pages are FAR clauses and other things that are hot links to other parts of the organizations, the government organizational documentation, for want of a better term. Those hot links link to something that's been incorporated and you have to get a copy of it and you need to keep it on record because if it changes, you're not going to the new requirement. You're using the requirement that was there when you went into the contract. There's an evolution. There's a documentation. There's a need for you to know how to do business. And time's up. And so thank you for joining me today on Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland, and tune in for our series on government contracting and grant compliance, what for-profit entities need to know.